This is a true crime in real-time roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crimes reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. Now we're headed to the U.S. District Court of Minnesota, where Vance Belter pleaded guilty to multiple charges Thursday related to stalking and killing Minnesota House of Representatives Speaker Emeritus Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark Hortman, as well as the stalking and shooting of Minnesota State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette Hoffman. Belter is a 58-year-old man who CNN described as a, quote, outspoken evangelical Christian. He also reportedly worked for a security company that advertised, quote, police-type vehicles. In his efforts to stalk and attack Democratic lawmakers, Belter reportedly impersonated a police officer. He was apprehended last year after a days-long manhunt. Reporter Mark Fry from WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities joined the station's Adam and Jordana show with Adam Carter and Jordana Green as news of Belter's guilty plea broke on Thursday, June 11th.
Mark, just take a second. Did Vance Belter have a chance to speak at all other than to just change his plea, or did his attorneys do that for him?
So he had a very interactive sort of back and forth dialogue with Judge Thunheim this morning as the judge read sort of the outline of the case. And then throughout the hearing today, Vance Belter's attorney read through the facts of the case and agreed to what those facts were in this case, Adam. And really, that was the extent of the speaking this morning, really, among anybody in there, was just sort of yes, no. The judge did ask Vance Belter how he was doing today. And again, Belter was very, very quiet in how he was talking, very soft-spoken, but still sounded very confident in how he was speaking, right from the get-go. And it was kind of interesting just to see the reaction the Hortman and Hoffman families were in the courtroom today as well. And one thing of note, Senator Hoffman, I think really the whole time was just leaned forward, just watching Vance Belter's almost every move. And that was something that really stood out to me this morning, Adam.
What did Vance Belter say to the judge? Did he address the case? Did he just give his plea? Did he address the families?
He has not addressed the family. So, Jordana, really what was happened today is Judge Thunheim brought in Vance Belter. Vance Belter sat down. They read the facts of the case to Vance Belter. He agreed if those were the facts of the case, including did he shoot and kill Mark and Melissa Hortman, to which he said yes. Did he stalk the Hortmans and other lawmakers? He answered yes. So it was really just outlining the facts of the case. There was really no full sentences spoken from Vance Belter this morning other than the initial, how are you doing this morning? And he said, I'm doing okay, thank you. And that was really just the extent, yes, no questions, and just agreeing to the facts of the case this morning.
Mark, I actually got chills when you said that Vance Belter said yes to the question if he killed Mark and Melissa Hortman. What was the Hoffman's family and what was the gallery's reaction to these acknowledgments?
Really, the biggest reaction, Jordana, that came this morning was during the facts of the case that were being read, and towards the very end when they were talking about when Vance Belter entered the Hortman's home and tried to flee, and sort of the final shot that rang out inside of that house on Melissa Hortman, and that probably drew the biggest reaction from the families here this morning, just an audible gasp. There was crying, and I think that was just what stood out to me, too, was just how focused they all were on Vance Belter. Sometimes in these cases, you see family members, they don't want to look at the perpetrator in this case, but that was not the case today. I mean, they were very much looking at him and listening to really every word that he was saying.
And you said Senator John Hoffman in the room. Was his daughter and wife there too?
His daughter was not in the room today, from what I was told, but his wife was with him this morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
And also we were hearing that nobody from the Belter family or any supportive friends were there. Is that also true?
That is true. Yeah, no one from the Belter family or really anyone that looked as if they were supporting Vance Belter was in the courtroom today. So that also stood out. One thing as well, too, is just the amount of just family members, extended family members, it looked like, from the Hoffmans and the Hortmans that were there, too. That really was sort of a signifying thing as well. But again, the bigger news today, too, the death penalty off the the case here. I mean, that was part of the big plea deal here today was he will not face the death penalty in two consecutive life terms with 40 years after that. That's going to be the recommended sentencing. Now, the judge can always sort of go off of that, but it sounds like that's going to be pretty consistent whenever that final sentencing date is set.
Good stuff, Mark.
We've heard a bit about Belter and his trial, so now let's take a moment to hear about his victims. We'll start with Melissa Hortman, formerly Melissa Halepsik. She was 55 years old. She was a Catholic who had served as a Sunday school teacher, and she lived in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Hortman grew up in the state and moved to Boston to get her Bachelor of Arts degree from Boston University. She graduated magna cum laude in 1991. She also earned her master's degree from Harvard and a law degree from the University of Minnesota. In the 1990s, Hortman made headlines for winning a civil case involving discrimination by landlords. She was elected to the Minnesota House of Representatives in 2004 and eventually became the Minnesota Speaker of the House. And that's just a bit about her career. In her personal life, she married North Carolina native Mark Hortman, who also attended the University of Minnesota for graduate school. He'd been working as a program manager at the time of their deaths on June 14, 2025. According to an obituary in the Daily Tar Heel, Mark Hortman also volunteered with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity for nearly 9 years. The couple shared two adult children. Thankfully, John and Yvette Hortman survived Belter's attack, but they were both hit by bullets when he shot into their home, disguised as a police officer. They faced surgeries and physical therapy in the months that followed. Hoffman was first elected to the Minnesota Senate in 2012, and he won multiple re-elections. His current term ends next year, and he's now running for re-election. Yvette previously worked in radio and then became a kindergarten teacher and advocate for children with disabilities, according to Radio Insights. The Hoffman's daughter, Hope, the person who called 911 when they were shot, has spina bifida. WCCO's Blois Olson and Vanita Sakar discuss the anniversary of the attacks this week, as well as developments in Belter's case.
How have people been handling this upcoming anniversary and also now this latest news in the political world?
I think everybody's been preparing to reflect. Listeners should be reminded that I have a little closer seat to this. I advise the Hoffman family on personal matters related to this. I'm not a lawyer, but I handle media related to the incident. So I've had a little upfront look, and we've been preparing for kind of a peaceful, quiet week. In fact, denying all media requests. And then this news started to break last weekend, and it just turns people up. That's what I would tell you, that, you know, from last weekend to yesterday morning, the churn of, is this really happening? What do we know? How is it going to happen? And I think it keeps everybody on edge. And I would just remind us, this is my take, it's not the Hoffman's take, and it's, you know, is that, you know, we should reflect on the incidents of the year ago and not let today's news, while it is news and it should get covered, overshadow the lives of Mark and Melissa and the trauma of the Hoffman family as a whole, by letting, you know, the alleged shooter steal the headlines. because I think everybody's kind of reflecting. The St. Paul City Council reflected yesterday. I myself am like, whoa, well, Thursday is going to be a different day in my mindset. And I think people close to them, but as a state, the best thing we can do is be civil, move forward, and remind ourselves that these folks, as public servants, became targets of a horrific plot.
Oh, it's hard to believe just what torture it's been for those who knew the Hortmans well, loved them. You know, I just think about them these past year and leading up to this and these court cases and all of that. It just adds to the nightmare. I want to just review real quickly, what are all the different ways Melissa Hortman is being remembered and how paid tribute to, as far as anything concrete that's happening at the state?
We'll start with the basics. The Hortmans wanted people to plant trees. So if people planted trees, and now the state will plant trees, there's Highway 610 will be named in the Mark and Melissa Hortman. There will be a garden at the state capitol. So I think those are the main ways. There's also a commission that's going to work on this memorial for the Hortmans through funding from this last state budget, supplemental budget. So I think there'll be many ways that they will be honored and remembered. There's also a movement to name the new state office building, or the remodeled state office building, the Hortman building. So I think, you know, there'll be constant reminders. I also just want to add that there's a certain surreal feeling about it being a year ago, because I just, that Saturday morning was so surreal, and now you start to relive it, and I think it's surreal still for many people.
I think you're absolutely right. When you look back on it, it just doesn't seem that it actually happened. How could something like that have happened? And certainly still people processing all of it.
Jason DeRusha of WCCO was joined by another local journalist to discuss the case this week.
All right, I want to get to Paul Bloom from Fox 9, because he was in the courtroom in federal court today when Vance Belter pled guilty to killing Melissa and Mark Hortman, shooting John and Yvette Hoffman, and showing up at two other state legislators' house with the intent of harming them as well. Paul Bloom with us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Paul, just reading the accounts of what happened and listening to our CCO radio reporters, it was emotional for me to hear it. What was it like in the courtroom today?
Yeah, chilling new details, you know, that we had not heard during, you know, Vance Belter's admission, during his allocution today. He's got to answer, you know, a steady dose of questions, you know, establishing that he is guilty of the crimes he's pleading to. And, you know, the most notable, and I'm sure you've heard it and sort of flagged it, is when he's at the Hortman house, you know, the horrifying details of assassinating, you know, the former DFL speaker of the house, inside her own home, you know, while she's fleeing up the stairs, you know, a very sort of deliberate planned out attack. He has this exchange with the husband at the door. Mark, you know, kind of makes, oh, Maple Grove police, there's been a shooting in the area. You know, who else is in the home with you? Oh, my wife. Oh, can you get her? I just want to make sure she's okay. Okay. You know, so he beckons, Mark beckons his wife. And then that's when, you know, Belter opens fire and chases Melissa up the stairs and kills her. And that Jewel, you know, loud sobs and crying and gasps across the gallery. It was a jam-packed courtroom. The Hoffmans, who were sitting front row, the Hortmans, you know, the parents, the adult children are in the courtroom. I mean, it was, yeah, that's a moment, a courtroom moment you don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah. And the families were so close, right? Like, they were sitting right there, right near where Vance Belter was sort of telling his story.
Right, especially, you know, the Hoffmans, they took the front row. So John and Yvette, right, they're shot, what was it, I mean, more than a dozen times total. You know, John should be dead. I mean, there should be a couple more murder counts. And in reality, right, that was, you know, the intent. He also kind of detailed what he did there, which, you know, again, started out as police kind of following up on a reported shooting. And then all of a sudden, he says it's a robbery. He forces them downstairs, makes them put up their hands. and that he opens fire, of course, their grown daughter, Hope, nearby. So those details. But, yeah, the Hoffmans were right there. I got a good view of John. And he was sort of on the edge of his seat as Belter is allocuting and kind of, you know, nodding yes to kind of, you know, he's detailing what happened. Of course, you know, I don't know what John's memory is of those horrifying moments, but seemed to be sort of nodding in agreement, laser focused on what the defendant was saying. But yeah, feet away. I mean, it's not, you know, I know you've been in a lot of courtrooms. I mean, the federal courthouse is a little bit bigger, you know, there's a little bit of space, but no doubt. I mean, not far at all. And, yeah, and it was just so old, so just matter of fact, just, you know, yes, I did it, guilty, you know, just...
No emotion.
Nothing. No, just on point. I mean, you know, I was just thinking, you know, he's now 58 or 57 when he carried out these attacks, you know, planned them for months, you know, no discernible criminal record of any kind. It just... You know, what we didn't get today, while we got these new details and a full admission, you know, he's planning it for months. Yes, he dressed up as police. Yes, he put on the silicone mask. He didn't say why, right? There was no component of motivation. Now, while Belter agrees to two life sentences plus 20 years on top of that, and it felt like in the court proceedings, you could probably just move on to sentencing today. Judge Thunheim will call back all the parties for a formal sentencing. And it is there where Belter will be formally given the opportunity to speak to the court. And perhaps there is where, you know, we kind of went in thinking, you know, will he rant at some point? You know, during his admission, will we hear something from him? But, you know, like, but I did it because, you know, so-and-so told me or whatever. We didn't get that at all today. So I think as we head towards the federal sentencing, I'll be curious to see what he does when given the opportunity to speak in court at a later date.
And it's always a double-edged sword, right, Paul? Because as much as I feel a little like as a society, we want to understand that, there's also nothing stopping a killer from making up some nonsense and saying whatever they want and re-traumatizing the family again with whatever sort of craziness he wants to say.
No, you're exactly right. And some of the early reports on this case, you know, I don't know if you remember, he was spouting out to some reporters early on from the Sherburne County Jail. There were his rantings and rants and, you know, in writing. And then clearly, I'm not going to give a medical diagnosis, but seemed to have some deranged thought processes. And there was an element of he's blaming Governor Walz and that kind of thing. So sure, no, he could traumatize the community again. He certainly could traumatize the families with what he has to say. We'll see if he says it. It's just as that reporter in me, I kind of wanted
want
a little bit more beyond the detail, just an explanation like what finally set him off. We heard about the planning. We heard about the use of the internet, the GPS devices, the stalking, the doing his research. Like, he knew names, he knew home layouts, he knew addresses. You know, he went to the two lawmakers in between. I mean, that night, I mean, it's been a year now, but, you know, the fact that, you know, I know law enforcement gets questioned about what happened, how he got away for the 43 hours he did, but if they don't intercept his vehicle at the home of the Hortmans and the arsenal he had there and the research he had done, it could have been a whole lot more bloodshed that weekend a year ago now.
Paul Bloom, Fox 9, was in the courtroom today. You know, we talked a little bit about the lack of emotion from Vance Belter. This had to be so hard for the families to sit there and face him. Was there emotion from them, or were they stoic?
I thought my best view was of John Hoffman, just the way the gallery works. His wife, Yvette, was on the other side of him, so I didn't get a good facial view of her, and the Hortmans were all sort of mixed together among supporters in the back. As I mentioned, you know, the assassination, the details in the Hortman house really drew what I would describe as the loudest and most overwhelming emotion.
We just didn't know that. Yeah. We didn't know, I mean, the details of sort of just how just horrific and manipulative with Mark Hortman, and then chasing Melissa essentially up the stairs and putting a gun to her head. I mean, just crushing to get those details.
Yeah, and you know, we go to these allocutions, and, you know, sometimes they're a little bit more antiseptic. There's, you know, did you use a gun? Did you do X? You know, did you, you know, you're kind of just establishing the sort of the letter of the law, like you have to admit to each and every sort of, you know, subdivision to sort of admit to the crime, and the court can then find you guilty of the crime. But yeah, those details, I mean, were shocking. I got, you know, I've covered this case as close as anyone right. for the last year. I had not heard those. And, you know, yes, the manipulation at the door, and like the that he knows, you know, she's likely in the house. He kind of concocts a story that there's been a shooting nearby. I'm here to check on it. Who else is at home? You know, he's at the door with Mark Hortman, the husband, and he admits to sort of asking who else is in the home. And he's like, oh, just my wife. She's upstairs sleeping. And then he's pretending to be a Maple Grove police officer. He says, well, I'll just need to see, you know, check on her to make sure she's okay before I leave. So like, that's what beckons Melissa sort of down the stairs to come into this horrifying exchange. And then, yeah, he chases her down and assassinates her, on her own stairs as she's trying to get away. And, I mean, just horrific, horrific details. And, you know, this does avoid a trial, right? I don't know. You know, I know people have some different, you know, opinions on this. Certainly followed social media, your listeners, others, our viewers, having mixed feelings. You know, the death penalty being taken off the table. Like, if this isn't the crime that the warrants a death penalty, what does? You know, politically motivated. He admitted he was going after lawmakers. Obviously, the U.S. attorney made that decision to not pursue the death penalty, but to take the sort of, you know, done deal. We get him. We have two life sentences plus 20 years on top of that. He's not going anywhere. He'll never take a breath of freedom again. That was enough for the federal government to take the death penalty off the table.
And you also wonder about, like, let's also be realistic in knowing that the victims in this case are Minnesota Democrats who in a state that doesn't have the death penalty. So as much as like I might have my own beliefs about what I think should happen, I think it's also fair to take a beat and acknowledge that I bet the victims' families have a divergence of opinion, or at least a number of opinions in that group as to what they think should happen.
Yeah, we know they were consulted, and by statute, certainly the family of the Hortmans is sort of, they're the victims of the death penalty crime because, you know, they were killed. But I know, you know, the Hoffmans also met with the U.S. attorney, and Daniel Rosen certainly listened to them. But yeah, no, there is a taking of opinion. My understanding from folks close to the victims' families was there was a divergent mix. You know, there were differing opinions on whether they wanted a death penalty sought. And, you know, with somebody telling me they actually thought or has been on record that Melissa was against the death penalty, I certainly am not. I don't cover the Capitol well enough to know her exact position. If I'm misstating it, I do apologize. But that there were some mixed feelings on that. But most notably, the one thing that I think controlled the possibility of pursuing capital punishment in this specific case was the legalities of it, right? Yeah. You mentioned Minnesota doesn't have it in state statute. So it had to be a federal offense, and the feds have to find an offense in which it fits to get a death penalty case. And what they've done is this sort of combination of murder and an interstate stalking, meaning you use the internet or GPS devices to stalk and then you kill. But in Luigi Mangione's case in New York City, where he jumps out in the dark and he attacks the UnitedHealthcare, you know, CEO and kills Brian Thompson, that charge was thrown out as a capital punishment charge in New York. And while not precedential in Minnesota, there was some thought that because it was similarly charged here in Minnesota, the stalking, the murder, that it might be hard to get that charge accepted as a death penalty charge through our district court. U.S. attorney says the circumstances are different enough. What happened in the Hortman home was as violent a stalk as you can get, as opposed to Thompson, where he kind of jumps out of the dark. There's no sort of fear created. It happens in seconds. It's done. It's over, as opposed to what took place in the Hortman home. They thought they could fight it, but they also could see it taking years and going up to the appeals court and the Supreme Court and decisions coming back and forth. And maybe it takes half a dozen years and we end up right where we did today. Why not just take sort of, you know, what you have in hand? He's willing to take the two life sentences. He's willing to accept a life behind bars.
And shut it.
Attorney Mike Bryant joined DeRussia to talk about the case this week as well.
Well, it obviously is, you know, for me, it brings back this guilty plea does bring back all of the emotions of that day almost a year ago. It is a heavy day for those who work in politics and for those who love this state. It is a reminder of just that horrific 48 hours and that horrific moment in our history.
Yeah, and Dan, for peace, I knew Melissa real well, and it just, yeah, it's a horrible thing to have something like that happen, and still really no understanding of why.
Yeah, I think that's the most frustrating thing when you have a plea deal and you don't have a full trial. Of course, I've covered plenty of trials. You've been an attorney in plenty of trials where you have a full trial and you still are not left with any real understanding of the truth as to what motivates people, right?
Right, correct, yeah. And, you know, that's the but, I mean, I don't know if there'd be any answer anybody would go, well, yeah, that makes sense.
Right,
but, you know, it's still a crazy thing. And I don't know. It's sad. Another sad example of, you know, some of the things that are going on in the world.
Let's talk a little bit about why there is sort of two trials. There's this federal trial that we had. Why in a case like this can somebody be charged federally and also face to an outsider what feels like the same bit on the state level?
Because there's different claims that are being made or different crimes that are being committed. There's a federal crime with the terroristic act or the political act that took place. And originally the thought was the feds got involved. And what happens when the feds get involved, they can preempt, which means they can take it over. And that comes into play. And so they got involved. And originally it was thought they got involved because there was going to be a death penalty part to that.
Right.
Because
right.
We don't have the death penalty in the state, and they were able to do that federally. Then a deal got made, and the deal basically was no death penalty in return for the sentence for life. And because of that, you know, it made sense for the defendant because he was facing the death penalty. Then the question came up, well, why are the feds involved? And there's a conspiracy side to it that they were trying to control the narrative so that it didn't look political as it could have. There's also the, you know, the outside discussion out there of whether or not he could then be pardoned because it's a federal crime. A president can pardon a federal crime where the governor can only pardon a state crime. I couldn't even comprehend that as a possibility with what took place in this case. So I'm with you.
I mean, I understand the conspiracy side of that. And look, let's be real. With the federal government right now, almost there's no such thing as inconceivable. But to me, that seems like people looking a little too hard to put the tinfoil hat on.
Yeah. It seems I couldn't comprehend the thought of a pardon there. But I don't think he has any kind of ties that would indicate something like that, where, you know, there's been people who have kind of bought their pardons over history, you know, as far as what's taken place there. But it does make you question why the feds got involved if they weren't going to just say, no, we're going to go for the death penalty no matter what. But they are. Now, it kind of makes the state case unimportant. The state can do a couple of things. One, the state can just kind of accept that the feds are taking it over and just let them have it. They could continue on just so they can get the conviction in state court, just to basically have a conviction. Then if something did happen, you know, it's kind of the reverse of what happened with Chauvin, where he was convicted in state court, and then they convicted him in federal court, and they went ahead and executed the federal court part of it, so he's in a federal prison. But the state sentence is still out there, so that if something did happen or there was some weird thing that happened that he was pardoned or something happened with the federal charge, you'd still have the state charges there to keep him in prison for the rest of his life. So he's in prison for the rest of his life. I don't see that that'll ever change. He can, you know, try to do some way off into the future, but I don't think that'll change as far as what the facts go.
Mike Bryant is with us, Bradshaw and Bryant, a criminal defense attorney. Mike, when you look at, you know, when you look at the state prosecution now, if you're Vance Belter, why wouldn't you take a plea deal at the state level? At this point, what's the difference? Unless you wanted to have the platform of getting on the stand and, you know, going through whatever was in his supposed manifesto.
Yeah, and that's a possibility that he may decide that no. Although the reality is, with the sentence he's already got in federal prison with the life, it's unexpected. There'll probably just be a sentencing and a plea and a sentencing, and there'll be not much else as far as the state goes. But it's possible he has a right to do that. And if he does, then you might have him wanting to take the stand to make some statement one way or the other.
In this case, the federal officials, there was some conflicting reporting over the last couple of days as to whether this case would have qualified for the death penalty. The U.S. attorney today said, no, I think, if we got a guilty, if we went to trial and got a guilty verdict, that he thinks it still might be death penalty eligible. At a certain point, I guess you have to weigh, and in all of these cases, you're weighing, is it worth putting the families through all of this stuff when you can at least say, look, this guy's going to be locked up forever?
Yeah. The death penalty is a tough thing for lots of people. A lot of people are opposed to it overall.
And we don't know what the victims' families in this case, we don't know where they were on this, right?
Yeah. And so based upon that, that you're right. I mean, you save the family having to go through it. You get the sentencing and he ends up going to prison. I've seen some people complain about the 40 years, but I mean, it's his life. He's going to be in there for life. And it's not, I don't think that's a concern as far as it goes. It's just a number that's being used to facilitate that.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.